Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as professor of law at NYU and senior lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the Supreme Court, religious liberty, and anti-discrimination laws. And Richard, we turn today to this recent Supreme Court case, Masterpiece Cake Shop v. Colorado Civil Rights Commission, in which the Supreme Court just recently handed down its ruling. Now, we have discussed this case in previous editions of the podcast, but just as a refresher to set the table, why don't you begin by reminding us of the specific question before the court in this case?
Well, the question was whether or not the provisions of the Colorado anti-discrimination law trump the First Amendment rights associated with religious liberty and freedom of speech. And it arises because Jack Phillips is a devout Baker, and nobody doubts the sincerity of his beliefs or think that he's a member of some made-up religion. And he is essentially a Christian fundamentalist. And the Bible says that gay marriages are essentially a sin against God. He regards making a cake in which he devotes his artistic energies in order to give people what they want as a master craftsman are a form of coercion with respect to his religious freedom and a form of compulsion with respect to his ability to speak. And so he refuses to do this. The commission comes along and says there's no religious liberty exception built into our particular statute. And as far as we're concerned, what this is an ordinary commercial transaction. Somebody's asking you to make a cake. They're not asking you to say that you do or do not agree with what is on that particular cake. The message is our own. It's not yours, Mr. Phillips. And so therefore, the laws apply to you. And in fact, if anything, they regarded his religious reasons as a reason to be aggravated, to make it worse, because they thought that if you start looking at religion, what it does is you're tying yourself into a long tradition in which the guise of religious liberty has been used to create a Holocaust, an Inquisition, Islamophobia, homophobia, and so forth. And at least one of the commissioners really landed with both feet. This is not alone. If you looked at the United States Civil Rights Commission headed by Martin Castro, when he was passing on this issue, there was a report which was very hostile to the religious claims and the free speech claims, but his off-the-cuff remarks were, again, anybody who wants to make this claim is not asserting a claim about religious liberty or a claim about freedom of speech. What they're doing is they're announcing to the world their extreme forms of bigotry, and they ought to be condemned for it. This is hypocritical and worse. So you cannot find a case in which it turns out that there's a more diametrically opposed set of opinions. And it's also the case that there are very, very few people who, when they talk about this, sort of say, this kind of is a tough case in the middle of the road. Most people are adamant on one side or on the other. It turns out this seems to be something, given the current law, that it's very difficult to find compromise on.
So let's get to the ruling. There was a lot of criticism of the media's initial reporting on this because you had headlines like "Court narrowly rules." Now, this was a 7-2 decision, but while the margin of victory wasn't narrow, the ruling actually was. Tell us how the court came down on this and what you make of it.
Well, I regard this opinion as an intellectual mess in which it turns out Justice Kennedy and perhaps the Chief Justice behind the scenes were desperate to come out with a decision that let this man off the hook, at least for the moment, but did not want to make any kind of decision which would resolve the extreme conflict between religious liberty and speech claims on the one side and the anti-discrimination laws on the other. So what they did is they found a rationale that was so narrow that you're not even sure exactly how it applies to the particular case. And so what Justice Kennedy did was to stress a couple of features about this situation which may not appear anywhere else. One of them was to note the extreme animus that members of the Colorado Commission had with respect to Mr. Phillips and said, look, you can't be a judge in a case in which you have such an extreme bias and an outcome. And this form of hostility means, in effect, that the decision turns out to be suspect. And then they also said, you've also had cases where people say gay bakers have come along and said they don't want to make cakes for people whose religion says my religion condemns same-sex marriage. And What they said is you're allowed to get out from underneath this particular prohibition because you find the things offensive. And so Justice Kennedy, I made the sensible point that what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. And if you have a commission which takes these sorts of inconsistent positions, then it turns out that this judgment has to fail. So what do they then do? What they do is they say the opinion below is reversed, full stop. And what this means, in effect, is at this point, he's out from underneath problem. But they didn't finish the sentence and said, and it's remanded for a new trial before a different board of the commission. They didn't say, and the case should be dismissed because the bias means that this thing is incurable. They just sort of let it hang there. So poor Mr. Phillips, who's gone through this for years, has been financially bankrupt and subject to all sorts of abuse, may yet be subject to another proceeding in which the commission would said, we have hereby expunged ourselves from all of this, come out exactly the same way, by announcing, we think that the anti-discrimination laws are a compelling state interest, which overrides claims of freedom of speech and religious liberty, and so therefore this particular conviction stands. It's also the case, as far as I can see, that any other hearing which avoids both the inconsistency on the one hand and the abuse on the other still does not know whether the religious claims and the free speech claims trump. What they do know is they can continue along their merry way until the Supreme Court says otherwise. And it's worth noting in this particular context, there have been four such cases that have gone on to state Supreme Courts. And there's not a single one of them in which the religious liberty claim has managed to garner a single vote. And so the Supreme Court clearly is on the opposite side. But they made this decision in this narrow way. And this is going to be a battle that's going to continue forward.
So, Richard, as you suggested early in that answer, it has been theorized that having this dull, not particularly instructive opinion was your price of admission for getting a 7-2 majority, and that getting that lopsided outcome may have been more important to some justices who place a lot of value on public perception of the court and wanted to avoid this being deemed a totally partisan exercise. Now, there's no way for us to know whether that's truth or just speculation. But for the sake of argument, let's just accept it here. It sounds like from what you just said in that answer that you think that trade-off wasn't worth it. So tell us why, if that was the calculus, they were overvaluing the public perception factor.
Well, first of all, the public knows that this thing was a huge dodge. And most people thought that they were entitled to have a clear rule. The second thing is that what you did is you had five justices and two separate opinions, one written by Elena Kagan for herself and for Stephen Breyer, and then one written on the other side by Neil Gorsuch, with essentially the support of Alito and Thomas, and then Thomas wrote separately on the free speech question. And if you look at those opinions, the antagonism between the two sides is perfectly apparent. Kagan goes out of her way to try to read this thing very narrowly. Gorsuch wants to go out of his way to read it in exactly the opposite sense. You look at the fine points on these debates and you hear such learned questions as, well, if it turned out that the cake was requested not by the two guys but by one of their friends, could you turn them down to make the cake when they are not gay? And then on the other side, Gorsuch says, what are you talking about under these circumstances? The issue here is not who's buying the cake. The question that you have to worry about is whether or not you've coerced this fellow in his particular religious beliefs. And so what's happened is it's very clear that if you had wanted to force this thing clearly one way or another, this case would have come out 5-4. The three that I mentioned would have joined Roberts and Kennedy in a tougher opinion, I think, and the other four would have dissented. And that's what I predicted. But Justice Kennedy has basically developed an acute case of balanceitis. That is, he seems to be extremely hostile at this point in his career to any kind of hard rule that gives anybody serious balance. And he seems to think that the Supreme Court is an institution which believes that the rule of any particular case should decide that case and no other. There was a case called Muir having to deal with the application of the takings clause to some riverfront property in the state of Wisconsin, and the opinion he wrote was so ad hoc that nobody knows what it means for the next case. And so I have another theory, which I'm just going to put forward, which is this has also happened before. It's called the 414 split. And what happens is you get four liberals who say, my God, discrimination laws dominate. Then you get four conservatives who say, what are you talking about? And you have Justice Kennedy saying, hey, I got this. I'm the man in the middle. And at that particular point, he will rule for the guy in exactly this form, but he will have nobody behind him on his opinion. So if you go to the case called Rapanos, which had to do with the scope of the Navigable Waters Act, you know, what counted as the waters of the United States, Scalia wrote a strong opinion which said that an upland is not water. The liberals wrote an opinion saying it most certainly is. And Justice Kennedy said, I'm going to remand this thing to figure out where it is. And then there was another case called Eastern Enterprises, where the question was how far back you went retroactively. And four justices that were condemning this thing relied on the takings clause. The four liberals said anything goes. Justice Kennedy says, I think this is a due process opinion. And it turns out that in future periods, it's 4-1-4. And everybody has been perfectly happy in ignoring the four conservative votes, even though Kennedy voted with them because he stated a different rationale. So it may well have been that what happened in this particular case is that what you did is you got this 7-2 opinion in order to avoid this 4-1-4 kind of split with Justice Kennedy pleasing only himself. I mean, as a lawyer, as an academic, I wrote this little piece on the SCOTUS blog, and I called it, you know, an attack on judicial minimalism. And the Supreme Court is not there to sort of figure out the nuances and facts in particular cases. It's supposed to lay down clear rules of one kind or another. And the question it has to ask is, an anti-discrimination law a compelling state interest which overrides religious liberties or not? And it's to that question that nobody bothered to turn.
I want to get you to a structural question that underpins this case, which you brought up in the SCOTUS blog piece. The action against Jack Phillips, the baker here, came via the eponymous Colorado Civil Rights Commission. Is it necessary or advisable to have bodies like that rather than the conventional judicial process handling these kinds of cases?
Well, I am a vigorous and persistent opponent of any specialized board. What happens is, if you go to a court of general jurisdiction and you have a trial by one person or by many, what you do is you get a random draw. And so people do not have strong pre-commitments on this or that issue, because when you're appointing them, you're appointing them to do a whole host of issues. So it's like saying to people, how do you get your groceries? We put a market basket together of 100 things, and you say you could pick this one or that one, and you're always going to have to get some surprises. There are going to be people there who will vote against you on some issues because they will vote for you on others you deem more important. So you get a much more balance. In this case, every member of that commission, I could recall reading the transcript, they were gung-ho civil rights types beginning to end. There were none of them who were on the other side of this particular issue. And so what you do is you get yourself an extremist body. In some cases, what you try to do is divide it between Republicans and Democrats, and that's like the National Labor Relations Board. And then you get the huge flip-flop. If you get the presidential appointment by a Republican, you get a conservative board. By a Democrat, you get a liberal board. And we can see right now the way in which they're trying to unravel it. So I am never, ever in favor of using so-called specialized tribunals, because the claim for expertise here is absolutely spurious. It's easy enough for anyone to figure out what's going on in this case. It's not like trying to interpret a complicated patent claim. But the bias issues are absolutely dominant. So what I would have done was declare the whole panel structure unconstitutional on those particular grounds. I do not think you can get due process out of specialized tribunals. And this issue is before the Supreme Court right now. There's a case called Lucia having to do with ad hoc tribunals set up by the Securities and Exchange Commissions in which they can try cases wrong. You never want somebody inside an agency or appointed by people inside the agency to do the adjudication. And then there was a case called Oil States Against Green Energy, in which you have the Patent Trials and Appeals Board, and it gets set up by people. And the head of the board announces, the case is not coming out my way. What I'm going to do is I'm going to sit on the panel myself and bring my best buddy along so as to change the outcome. And the Supreme Court, in a horrible decision by Justice Thomas, upheld this particular travesty. And it upheld it 7-2, really strong dissent by Justice Gorsuch, excellent kind of opinion. But the whole thing is the due process issue dominates everything else. And so what's so ironic about all of these cases is when you have these special structures, the due process objections are powerful. And in all of the cases that I've just mentioned, three of them before the Supreme Court this year, the due process issue has not surfaced. Because I don't believe, although Lucia has not been decided, that it will surface there. It's a technical question of who gets the right to appoint inferior officers under the United States Constitution. So I believe, in effect, on the process side, I just strike the panels down. And then the important question, I think, is, well, what do you think about the substantive issues? Hint.
Well, go right ahead, Rich. It's always helpful for me when you ask your own questions.
Well, I mean, do you disapprove of my question?
No, go right ahead.
Look, the argument that I made, I wrote a brief in this particular case. To say that it was ignored is an understatement. None of the briefs that were filed were taken into account. But the brief I wrote was a very different kind of brief with a man named Sean Gates. And what we did is we had a couple of things. One is we put a map up in the brief. And the map simply showed where the bakery was in Lakewood, Colorado. And then we had dots for all the bakers that were within, say, a half a mile of it. And there were 27 or 67 other bakers there. Jack Phillips, when he said no, the couple decides to waltz off. And what they do is they end up at a baker 200 yards away who gives them a cake for free. If you actually are talking what the legal damages are, apart from the criminal sanctions that are imposed, it's the cost of walking those 200 yards. Ironically, no one figures in the damage side of this issue, the so-called dignitary issues that are dominant. So as far as I'm concerned, the correct rule has always been forget about religion, forget about speech, understand the fundamental mistake in the civil rights laws. And that mistake is to impose any duty on anybody to serve anyone for any reason in a competitive market. Because what happens is everybody then starts to say, well, my reason is good and your reason is not good. Your religion is bona fide and my religion turns out to be ad hoc, or maybe it's the other way around. Or your people turn out to be bad and my people turn out to be good. What happens is if you allow the dignitary stuff to change the way the world longs, what happens is you then do what always happens in these cases. One guy's dignitary institutions or sentiments count for everything. The other guy's stuff count for absolutely nothing. And so when all of the civil rights groups start talking about the dignitary interests of a gay couple, you ask them, well, what are you supposed to do about Jack Phillips, who's been pilloried from post to post, denounced, attacked, berated, and belittled under these cases? Does this guy have a dignitary interest? Is he acting in bad faith? Do you really hate the guy? When it turns out he says, buy anything you want off the shelves. Here's a place that you can go to get you the cake. So it's a balance of interest. And the balance of interest is you never have a compelling state interest to force anybody to serve anybody in a case where cheap alternatives are available. And the great hazard of allowing offense to become the dominant feature is the more angry you get, the more indignations you start to display, the greater your rights against somebody else. And what we're trying to do is to lower the heat, not trying to raise the heat. And so the notion that offense counts as a form of actionable harm is a great mistake. So I don't think there's any state interest whatsoever in forcing this guy to do it. This was the issue, if you remember, in the Smith case against the Employment Commission about smoke and peyote, and the whole question about whether or not you can impose a neutral law on this particular fellow. And the answer that the Supreme Court said is sure, you can, if you have a general law, you could require Jewish servicemen to eat pork instead of having to make accommodations. And there's no government interest whatsoever strong enough to do that in a competitive market. And so I would repeal Title II of the Civil Rights Act. That gets out of all of this problem. The same thing with the states, and put the anti-discrimination laws where they always belong, which has to do in the provision of standardized services like electricity and pipe services, gas, travel on an airplane, and so forth. Then you have a non-discrimination duty. And if somebody has a religious aversion against taking people on his airline, they don't have to fly United. They can basically go into another line of business. That's the correct accommodation. And the thought that somehow or other the anti-discrimination law are compelling state interest to override religious freedoms is desperately wrong. When they were first put into place, this conflict wasn't there. And what was commonly said is that you have a rational economic basis to do it. This makes some sense in connection with transitions to the terrible situations in the South. But if you're trying to worry about the situations where we have voluntary markets without corrupt police forces, the reason this case creates these problems is that we give undue deference to the anti-discrimination law and competitive markets. That's what we wrote in our brief. There's never been a same-sex couple that can't get all the services they want from thousands of websites. Why you have to beat up poor Jack Phillips when nothing on the other side's at stake remains a lamentable mystery to me.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter. That's at Richard A. Epstein. You can read The Libertarian, his weekly column, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.